Hello, everyone. This is Mike Quinsey, Connecting the Light. My guests today, we have two, are Ted Denmark and Julie Lauer. Julie is a trance channel with what she describes as a shifting group of inner space, outer space denizens, who evidently are always waiting to greet her, and they're unified by the star table. And they call these sessions, I think I'm correct in saying, telepresence conferences. Now, I'm going to speak with both Ted and Julie, but a bit later in the program, possibly for the last 15 minutes, I will be speaking to Julie about her new book called Goddesses for Every Day. So welcome to the program, both Ted and Julie.
Thank you so much.
Hello from the California motherlode to everybody out there.
Right, thank you. Now, Ted, I think most people would be interested in knowing how this started with you and Julie. I certainly would. So would you like to introduce yourselves by way of telling us how you got together and got into the telepresence conferences?
Yes, Mike, of course. Well, you know, we're both astrologers and have been for a number of years, and I had been reading Julie's articles in the magazine Atlantis Rising for some time and began to realize that I was really enjoying these articles a lot. So I finally acknowledged that I was by sending her an email a couple of years ago, and she responded very nicely, and before long we realized that we had quite a few things in common. And after a while, we actually spoke by phone, and a little bit after that, we got together out in southern Colorado there where she lives, and sort of spontaneously were led to this idea of doing these trance sessions because she had just recently begun experimenting with some of her friends there who were doing hypnotherapy, and I, with my philosophical and psychological and educational background, was also interested in the same subject and had done some hypnotic inductions previously. And so we sort of began sort of to experiment, really almost without realizing that we were doing it. And then this fantastic experience suddenly appeared in the first session, which I took notes for very hurriedly. And it was so amazing, we decided to do another one, which I also took notes for, and by about the third session, which was really quite amazing to me, I had studied channeling quite a lot in my background and was really quite interested in the subject of the masters and the ray masters and the ETs of various kinds for some time. And I suddenly began to realize that at the fourth session that these were so good that I should actually begin to record them, which I did, which we did. And after that, I began making transcripts, and then that all led up to the book of the first 14 sessions called The Star Table Transmissions, which fairly amazed us, actually, even though we knew quite a lot, and we both had been contactees ourselves for quite some time. But in some ways, both of us really had not converged around a personal understanding of really what it was about for ourselves personally, even though, you know, we had heard about quite a few other people, and I had studied the Billy Meyer contact reports for a number of years and actually began to rewrite and re-edit them into English after Wendell Stevens' sort of somewhat premature publication of the early English transcripts. So after that, things actually converged very rapidly, and now we have really come to a realization that our contactee, our early contactee experiences really were quite extraordinary, and a quite extraordinary kind of circumstance has been revealed to us both.
Right, that's an interesting start. Obviously, you can't detail too much through so many sessions, but tell us about the first time you ever had a session with Julie, because I believe that went back to only as recent as the beginning of last year. Is that correct?
Yes, it's all quite recent and has developed very quickly. The first volume, which I mentioned, Star Table Transmissions, is in the first revision. It's still a preliminary book, and we're still working on it. We have all kinds of interesting ideas that really quite should definitely be added to it, which we are going to be doing this winter. The second volume of the second set of the telepresence conferences is called Star Family Excursions, which is also quite extraordinary and has pushed us even beyond the first volume. And we're now collecting the sessions for Volume 3, which as so far is unnamed. But we in the background have also been following the Salusa emails, the webcasts that you've been doing, which have been very exciting to us because many of the things that we've learned have either been somewhat confirmed or have been somewhat extended and brought to a slightly different perspective by the really, really interesting transmissions that you've also been doing. And so just recently in our last session, which we did last week, number 32, the entity Salusa also appeared at the table with us. And many of the other familiar ETs that have been coming to the sessions for the whole time. So things are still very, very lively. And, of course, we're very, very excited about the Olympics and some of the ideas that have been opened about the possibility of the Declaration Day, which is actually tomorrow. And so it's really quite an extraordinary situation that we find ourselves in right now.
Yes, indeed. And I might add at that point that at the moment, to my knowledge, there are two message sources that are definite about tomorrow being the actual time of some form of disclosure. There are another three messages, including Salusa's, that talk of the complete period of the Olympics, which of course end on August 27th. And Matthew keeps a little bit more, I wouldn't say reserved, but he doesn't say that it won't happen, but his feeling is that it will take somewhat longer. So there we are. There's a lot of support there, and there's been two other messages that have spoken of some tremendous event which is coming, which will change the world. So it is looking very exciting.
Yes, indeed.
Now, the first person I think you ever channeled, if that's the right word to use, was Athena. Would you like to say anything about that first contact you had?
Julie, would you like to describe that?
Sure. And I think that's really true. Actually, that was, I think, in the first session that we recorded when I was out in California with Ted. And I knew or had been told by psychics that a person named Athena was one of my guides. What I really didn't know prior to that time was that Athena was also the partner of the Master Hilarion. And so it turns out that we've had quite a lot unfolding with that. The very early session, I think it was actually our third time to try it, but probably our first formal session when Ted was taking copious notes. We hadn't recorded it. That was, I think, the third one. And she showed up in the very beginning and took me on this amazing journey to another star system, to a planet. And I recall a lot of it vividly because there was this amazing temple with pillars looking very much like probably something we might have seen in a picture from Atlantis or even Greece much later, open to the sky with stars that were unfamiliar, and she revealed to me images of a zodiac with different figures. And that was sort of, in many ways, the beginning. Ted and I had both apparently lived in that star system, which was part of the star which we now call Lyra, in that system, which, of course, is, according to what we've heard, and other sources, I believe, as well, one of the big origin points for humanoids that have appeared in many star systems. But it was the beginning of, in many ways, this remarkable experience that we're having. I'm able to see things completely in color and 3D, and the way it appears to my mind's eye. Sometimes I see pictures, sometimes people speak to me, sometimes I receive things telepathically. But that visit from Athena was probably as you were saying, Mike, sort of the opening of the portal for this experience. And that was January of 2011.
Right. Now, just to set the record straight here, are all your contacts actually through trance sessions?
That's a really good question. I would say the formal ones are, but what also happens to me at times is that I receive spontaneous messages that happen, I hear, that seem either telepathic or sometimes I hear an audible voice. Most often they come from the person who I think is my primary guide. Her name is Ariel, but I also get messages from Athena. That's much rarer, and I never expect it. I do ask questions sometimes, and I did ask a question, which we can talk about later, about what's happening with August 4th, and I believe I have an impression based on that, which is certainly probably as reserved as anyone else is. I'm not as willing maybe to go out on a limb, but most of the time they do come through the formal trance sessions that Ted and I do, and I feel that his presence and his support and ability to hold the space is critical to what I do. But occasionally I do get these spontaneous messages as well.
Right. Now, you've got a name here that seems to be peculiar to the work you do, in the sense that you talk of star table transmissions. Now, explain what that is, because people might think it's something that is here on the Earth, whereas I believe it's actually somewhere that you go to. Would you like to explain that?
Sure. And that's a really good question as well. In normal trance work, well, I should say, I think in the kind of work that many of the people that I worked with in the beginning, or several, I should say, worked with a particular person who developed a form of hypnotherapy called alchemical hypnotherapy. And I think I've worked with three people other than Ted. And in most cases, it's a very simple process of imagining sort of different states of consciousness. What happens to me often is that I seem to be transported to different locations. Sometimes it happens automatically. Sometimes it happens as if I enter a spacecraft and travel. And the first time that the star table experiences occurred, that's what happened. I got into a spacecraft, and it would move faster than the speed of light, and I would land, the craft would land in a particular place, and I exited and entered a building that was shaped like a five-pointed star. And inside was a room that grew. The room kept getting larger in the early sessions, and there was at the center a table shaped like a five-pointed star. So that's where the name star table came from. Right. We were told it was in the system of Aldebaran, and there was a being who appeared always, sort of like the facilitator of the sessions, who was like an orb of light. And he was a representation, said, it felt like male energy to me, of the actual star that we call Aldebaran, which is the bull's eye in the constellation of Taurus. So different people would show up at these sessions and appear around this star table. So that's where the names. So the first book, the first sessions, all appeared in this room. And I would arrive there or be sent there, usually in some form of spacecraft.
Right. So has every session since that time also come about the same way? Is it always that you go to the star table to meet people and have a discussion or whatever?
I would say that and Ted, jump in here if you have a different thing you'd like to say. The first 14, I believe, all occurred at the star table.
Yes, that's right. The first 14 sessions all have the commonality of the star table, but then it becomes a bit more varied in volume 2. The star table does not show up so explicitly after volume one?
There's almost always a table, however, and there's almost always, it could be a different shape, and that was what was interesting about the second book. There was almost always like a conference table idea, so that was a focus. It was always the star-shaped table in book one, but I think in book two the table had completely different shapes. The most recent session that we did, the table had eight sides, so that was a completely different one. But the table seems to be a common point of focus.
And we always wonder about the symbolism of the number of the sides and the shape.
Right, yes. So as you've progressed, I gather you've met beings from different civilizations. And I think at some early stage you met some of the Pleiadians. Now, they seem to be very prominent in conveying messages to people on the Earth at the moment, and they seem to take a rather special position in our lives, or our history, I should say, because they've had a lot to do with where we are today. Now, what do you know about them?
Well, that seems to be correct, and I have spent really quite a lot of time poring over the Billy Meyer contact reports that have appeared and are really only finally beginning to appear in English. I have actually retranslated, rewritten, re-edited the first four volumes, the actual only four volumes of Wendell Stevens' series called Message from the Pleiades, which was the story of the initial contact of Semjassi. The Swiss say Semjassi, of course. I say Semjassi with a hard J now, who first contacted Billy Meyer, and of course it was her and the mission that she was the liaison person for, including her father and Quetzal, who was the mission commander and so forth. And they had outlined really quite an extensive program beginning in 1975 that would open a totally new chapter in this kind of contact process between the Earth and the Pleiadians, who had been assigned basically to our planet to try to now again in a whole new instance begin a process of trying to reestablish contact and to try to begin to pull the Earth up out of the dangerous war condition that had fallen into with the Second World War and so forth. And that was of great interest to me, and of course I felt a really, really special kind of relationship with Semjassi. But the whole thing, and then I began to have my own contact experiences about 30 years ago at Mount Shasta here in California, where I saw, when I was out skiing one day, a group of three UFOs that came right out of the clouds on the top of Mount Shasta, to my great shock, actually, even though I had been somewhat prepared for it the whole morning. They came out and they flew right over my head, and I almost fainted, actually, but that was my first contact that I really ever had. Some years before, I had, when I was living in Colorado, I had experienced a white eagle that appeared to me unexpectedly one day. And I really never knew what it was about, actually. It happened rather quickly, but this, you know, white eagle appeared and looked at me very, very intently. And I really didn't know what it was about. And I really was puzzled for many years, as I had many other kinds of contact experiences of a rather unusual kind, actually, all different, seemingly related to the Pleiades at some of the time. And it really wasn't until Julie and I began to do our work together, in which we had, I think, finally passed our initiation rite to be able to really delve deeper into this mystery to find out really what was going on. And it was then that we actually were able to make contact with some of the ETs like Semjassi and a number of the others that we have since learned a great deal more about. These individuals come evidently from a time 300 years into the future for the most part, and they're involved in Earth in a number of projects, and they have, as we have gone through book one, they have revealed to us, who we really are, and the way in which we are actually related to them, which, of course, was a rather mind-blowing experience for us to find out. And we are still somewhat cautious about describing that, but we are beginning to try to actually talk about it in a way that makes sense to other people so that we can actually begin to describe what our mission is.
Right. Now, you mentioned white eagle there, and you've referred to it as a mysterious bird entity. Do you mean by that that you have conversed with the white eagle?
Well, the initial white eagle was a mystery, and then a second white eagle appeared in the Grand Canyon when I had my second, what I would consider, major close encounter there, in which a white eagle that was flying up the River Canyon there when I was watching with binoculars after I had seen what looked like a UFO crossing the desert at a fairly far distance out into the desert from where I was at the campground. And then I noticed this white eagle again flying up the canyon, and when it got very close to me, I began to get frightened, actually, and I put down my binoculars sort of by instinct, and there was a full Pleiadian beam ship about 50 feet away from me up in the middle of the air looking down upon me, and I really had to try to summon within myself whether I was really ready to find out what was going to happen next and was I about to be abducted or something of that kind. But nothing like that happened, and there were no untoward results of it. But I was given a bit of a shock, and so that was the time in which the Pleiadian ET that we have come to know as Findar, who was described as my future self from the Pleiades 300 years in the future, made his next closer approach to me because he had been the mystery behind the appearance of the first white eagle, who had projected a kind of holographic representation of himself to me as a way of revealing to me how the Pleiadians for my whole life had been somehow manifesting themselves to me in a symbolic way through bird experiences that I had had from my earliest days as a child on a farm in Oklahoma.
Right. Now, you referred to a beam ship, and I believe I'm correct in saying that is one that is peculiar to the Pleiadians. And often
that's what they call their small spacecraft. They're what is like a car for them, the way they get around.
Right.
To go from their home in the Pleiades on the planet Taygeta, how they come here, and they've actually accelerated their technological developments even over the course of the last 30 years so that they can actually almost instantaneously arrive from the Pleiades now to any location by a process they call transmission here on Earth, and they can actually materialize their beam ships through a process of time travel or time and space travel or space-time travel to actually dial in a process of actually making contact with a situation or an exact location here on Earth to interact in a way that is part of their agenda with the individuals that are their contact people that they have actually made rather elaborate arrangements with over a long period of time, like us. And that's what they have actually revealed to us, that our contact experiences that we had in earlier days were the early stages in which we were being prepared for this now more conscious contact process.
Right. And when you talk of beam ships, of course, Billy Meyer took probably the most clear and best photographs ever taken of that type of craft.
Yes, indeed. No one has ever really quite duplicated his amazing efforts. And it's because Senjasi and Quetzal and some of the others actually posed the spacecraft for him to actually be able to take pictures of. Mm. Many of the more surreptitious pictures of ET spacecraft are not anything like that because there wasn't the same kind of established relationship in which they were actually trying to reveal themselves through their allowing of their spacecraft to be photographed.
Right. Now, it seems to me, which I've mentioned a little earlier, that the Pleiadians are very active at the moment, and that would be expected, bearing in mind that we have the winter solstice coming up and the end of this cycle. Now, do they talk to you in respect of that? Do they give you any information about how it's going to work out?
We've asked a lot of questions
to Julian Trans, and we have gotten quite a lot of amazing answers that supplement each other in various ways, and probably some Jossi the Pleiadian and my longtime guide friend from the Hilarion sessions with John Fox that I did over a period of the last 30 years are the primary contact people who seem to be the ones who organize and arrange these sessions that we have with these other ETs. And they are the ones who tend to answer our questions, I think, most explicitly, because they're the ones who really understand us the most and have become quite familiar with us over the years. So there are really quite a few very, very interesting questions that we've tried to ask to try to reveal more about what really is going on these days in the world. And that's what the books are really about, of course, and there's really quite long, extensive questions and answers about all kinds of cosmic things going on in our local neighborhood. Just to give you an example, one of the things that I found most interesting is the fact that we've been told about this, what is called a brown dwarf that we have called Tyche, which is a small, dim star that is actually the companion of our star and our solar system that has really never been known and is not really known currently by our Earth astronomers. But this solar companion of the Earth is now coming very, very close to our solar system, which is one of the main causes of what we call this global climate change process that's going on the Earth. But not only on the Earth, all of the other planets as well are also experiencing similar kinds of conditions of change that have been described by the NASA scientists, even though it's never been given much publicity in terms of a coherent perspective. So what we are being told is that this dark star, this infrared entity that is approximately four times more massive than Jupiter, which now has reached its closest approach to our solar system, is what is really behind many of the transformation processes that are going on, in which the Earth will receive a kind of initiation, the whole solar system will receive a kind of initiation, and much of what we have been calling ascension is about for the people who are ready to experience this kind of transformation in consciousness that is now occurring, that has now occurred for many people, and that it's one of the things that we've been most interested in trying to understand and describe for the benefit of people who have heard various kinds of things about the so-called end times and so forth. And so that is one of the main themes, but there are many, many other quite fascinating themes. I myself have a background professionally in space science as a design engineer, and so I spent many decades actually working with astrophysicists and have something of a working knowledge of what is known in contemporary astrophysics today. But what we've been told actually goes pretty far beyond what anything the official science people really either know anything about or even want to contemplate discussing, actually, at this time. So it's really very, very exciting to me, personally, to have answers to some of these questions. But I have actually also spent quite a lot of time in terms of the philosophical and the psychological dimensions as well, because those are also the kinds of things that I've been also quite involved in my kind of dual career lifetime.
I'd like to add just a couple of comments to what Ted said.
Yeah.
I think that we've been told something that seems significant to me. We've been told that as we move through the rest of this year, that we will experience a sense of unprecedented acceleration, I believe both of time and energy and frequency. That's sort of the way I understand it. But that as we pass through it, for most of us, in some ways, as we look back, it will not seem catastrophic, as many of the prophecies have been, but that as we look at it, we will say, well, of course, that's the way it had to unfold. So we, of course, have wanted to know, will things be horrible? We've asked questions about the financial crisis, And in fact, at the last session that we did, where I was quite surprised to see the being Faluza, and of course I have to say, I have to trust that that's actually what happened, but he spoke about the current LIBOR scandal, saying it was the tip of the iceberg, and he explained that a global financial catastrophe was being prevented and that people, trusted people, capable people, were waiting in the wings to take the places of corrupt criminals who would be removed. And while there might be disruption in certain cases, it would not be a complete financial collapse. However, that the current system would fail, would end, and that a new, much more enlightened system would come in its place. So those are a couple of what for us were very powerfully positive and confirming things that we have been told.
Yes, well, it's certainly very good to hear that in spite of many prophecies for this period over perhaps many years, that in fact it's not going to be quite as severe or catastrophic as some people think. That's very reassuring.
Yes, indeed, and I'm going to chime in a little bit too mm-hmm. Continue perhaps what is probably the most significant message that we have been hearing, that indeed it's a time of great rejoicing, this particular time that we're in right now, because these ETs have appeared at this particular time in our history to themselves begin to conduct the negotiations for world peace with the major governments, and that most of the primary leaders in the world have already been notified that this is their intention, and that in fact what makes it such a great time for rejoicing is that the Earth is now very, very close to being ready to being inducted into the Galactic Council, so that the quarantine, basically, of isolation that the Earth has been in for a very long period of time because of so many very, very disastrous historic episodes, is now ready to make the great step onto the world galactic stage and to take its place, and that, in fact, all of the nuclear weapons have already been decommissioned by them worldwide, and that they will not allow a World War III to be started by people who may, in the process of trying to push their agenda at any cost, they will not be allowed to actually allow this to happen. And that's the good news that I was especially particularly grateful to hear myself, even though I was very shocked to hear what we were told.
Mm, absolutely. I think we've been getting messages of that nature for quite some time. But the more people that know that all is going to turn out very well, I think the less fear will be created amongst them. And, of course, that's the last thing we want, is people to get fearful about what will happen in the end times. Now, in some of your contacts you've had, and maybe perhaps Julie might be the ones to answer this, I see you've had some information about Nibiru. What is your take on that one? How do you see its part, maybe, in the end times?
Well, I think I would say that in some ways that's what Ted was explaining with what's called the brown dwarf, and I tried to give a non-technical answer. Of course, Zechariah Sitchin is the person who is most well known for decoding Sumerian cylinder seals.
Indeed, yes.
And explaining that. All of that is a really fascinating and huge area of research. There's a lot of information in the Bible and other texts that many people have pondered what it meant. And so, according to Sitchin, he believed Nibiru was, he called it a 10th planet or 12th planet, that had an orbit of about 3,500 years, roughly, I think that's right, and that as it came on a close approach to Earth, it created great catastrophes. There's a lot of information in other places and in the Meyer contact information, too, that describes, I think, the catastrophic events as being caused by something else called a destroyer comet. I believe that what Sitchin interpreted as Nibiru is, in fact, this other star, this brown dwarf, a body that never had enough mass to ignite, and so it burns with a dim glow. The knowledge of that, by the way, interestingly enough, appeared in the Hindu Vedas from thousands of years ago, and it's what they based the yugas on. And the closer that this brown dwarf comes to Earth, the more we get to the point of a golden age. So in other words, the closer the two stars are together, the more symbolic it is and the more light, and then the farther that the star and the sun from each other, the darker it becomes on every level. So if what we're being told is true, and by the way, there's a lot of scientific evidence for this. There's a couple of teams of scientists who have predicted this based on cyclical evidence in the geological record. Very interesting. There were geologists who talked about this. They couldn't figure out why at these intervals. They were much longer periods, 64 million years and 34 million years. So they went to astrophysicists who began doing the studies. So what our sources are telling us is that the cycle is smaller than either what's called the precession of the equinoxes, a period of approximately 26,000 years, that the cycle is closer to 6,000, and that we're getting closer to that, and as Ted said, this other star is coming to its closest point. So that feels really right to me, and they believe that it will appear in the part of the sky where we call Virgo, coming from that direction. So there's a lot of also ancient symbolism connected with that. Even as recently as the Greek symbolism, there was a goddess whose name was Astraea from that part of the sky, who it was said gave all the great laws and wisdom to Earth, but then as the world became dark, she departed because humanity became evil, but that at some point she would return. So even as recently as the Greek myths, there are things that that reveal this knowledge that we've probably forgotten. So I think hopefully we'll get to see it soon. Perhaps that's going to be part of the revelation that will occur in the immediate future.
Yes, there does in fact seem to be quite a few different opinions as to what Nibiru is and where it is now. For example, some people believe that it is in fact already within our solar system. From what you've said, in fact, it must be some distance away at the moment. Is that correct?
The sessions say that Tyche is approximately one light year away at its closest approach, which was in late 2011.
Okay,
it supposedly
fine.
Never gets closer to us than what is called the Oort cloud, but to be able to disturb the far reaches of the solar system. And I can't remember how many astronomical units or light years that is, but this particular body never enters our solar system. It only, as Ted says, comes one light year at its closest approach. And I can't remember how many trillion miles or how many miles a light year is equivalent to.
Yeah, the light year is the outer edge of the Oort cloud, and we were also told that this newly discovered body called Sedna is actually in orbit around Tyche rather than around our sun, which was pretty amazing.
Okay, now some other people have felt that it represented some form of danger to us, but from what you're saying, that is not in fact the case. So what is its purpose in sort of linking with us?
Well, I'm going to answer that mythically. I didn't say that before. It's interesting. I mentioned briefly that there were two teams of astrophysicists working on this. One team named this body Nemesis, who is after the Greek goddess. Her name means due enactment and punishment. And so all of the psychology and mythology around that naming convention would imply great disaster and catastrophe. And that particular group of scientists believes the body is a red dwarf, which are the most common stars in our galaxy, astronomers estimate that maybe 75% of stars are red dwarfs. The other team looking at it took a completely different view and named the body Tyche, who is the sister of Nemesis, but she's the goddess of good fortune. So it's really very interesting. It's almost as if all of the information about this expresses the polarity of thinking that exists on the planet. And just as you said, Mike, I would agree with you. I think the worst thing that any of us can do is give in to fear. I think that, so my choice is to look at the sister who brings good fortune and not at the sister who brings divine retribution. So I think it's interesting. But there may well be something else that is Nibiru. We've not been given any information about that as a separate body.
Okay. Now, Satyarāya Sitchin seemed to indicate that the Anunnaki came from Nibiru, and in fact, I think it would be quite correct to call them the false gods. So if Nibiru doesn't enter our solar system, presumably when it came at its nearest distance, they must have launched some other type of craft to reach the Earth. Would you know anything about that?
Well, if I'm recalling correctly, I believe I asked about Nibiru specifically, and I've forgotten who told me, but one of the science consultants, ET science consultants, told me that Nibiru had existed in ancient times, but in fact no longer does, and it somehow was a part of a destruction process that occurred that may have been related to what happened with the asteroid belt and certain things like that. It's a little bit hard for me to recall specifically, but evidently, if I'm recalling correctly, and I think I am, we were told that Nibiru, though it once did exist, no longer exists.
Oh, good. I'd forgotten that.
Yeah. So it really has no bearing, really, at the current time, and that, in fact, Tyche is the real entity of significance that many people attribute some of these other aspects to. What really Nibiru was about in the ancient times, I don't think I really asked enough about to really find out exactly what had come from, where it had come from, and so forth. But the histories that Sanjasi gives of the Earth that go back many, many tens of thousands of years describe an enormous number of events in which extraterrestrials from many, many parts of our local galaxy were involved in circumstances on the Earth of various kinds. They themselves, the Pleiadians, had the most extensive contacts, but there were many involvements of various kinds with Arcturians, Cygnians, Andromedans, and Lyrans of various kinds over a very long period of time. So something like Nibiru, which is almost the only thing that many people have heard about, or perhaps like the Greys, the only kind of extraterrestrials that most people have ever heard about, are really only a small part of the picture that has been revealed in what we have gotten answers for.
Hey, that's fine, because I'm sure people that have an interest in these type of subjects obviously know something about Nibiru, which I think has also been called Planet X and probably other names. But it seems the history of it is a little bit blurred. But as long as it has a positive input, I think that's all that matters. Now, you occasionally, I guess, get to talk about subjects that relate to events that are happening on the Earth when you go to the star table. You've had evidently some interesting conversations with Hilarion and Athena. What have been their recent comments about what is happening in the world? I mean, are they happy with the way it's progressing?
Well, that's an interesting thing, and Ted will want to comment on this, too. Of course, I think that we, like a lot of people, look at the world and see a lot of collapse, a lot of disintegration and deconstruction, and it is easy to be concerned about how that impacts us. And also increasing revelations about what might be called secret governments or dark cabals and so on, and what is happening with that. But they consistently tell us that even though it may appear that things are ending or disappearing or are being deconstructed, I love that word, that in point of fact, it's actually going much better than we can imagine, and that even though our attention may be focused on what's wrong, certainly the media helps with that, that they are encouraged very much so by the process of change and by what they term as the increase in humanity's positive consciousness. So they give a very encouraging picture, and as you said earlier, Mike, Athena especially repeats that the most important thing we can do is to hold our consciousness in a high level of light and love, which, by the way, I think is exactly what you do with your messages from Salusa. They are of such a high vibratory frequency. I am always uplifted after I read them and feel that I've had a very positive experience. So that's in essence what I think they're challenging us to do. What are your comments on that, Ted?
Yes, I would have to say something quite similar. Almost all of the ETs that I have listened to most carefully, who are so persuasive in what they have to say, such as Samjase and Hilarion and Athena and Oran and a number of the others, all say that even though things look rather dark and scary in a lot of ways, things are actually moving along in a very positive fashion, and that many of the dark elements that exist in the world today, both inside and outside of governments, are basically being checked and checkmated with some of their nefarious adventures, both in the financial world and in the world of wealth and power and war-making strategies and so forth, and that the time is very, very short for them, and that very soon the positive elements will really make it very, very clear what the future of the Earth is going to be, and that the transformation of the financial system is going to be into a situation in which basically we're going to get into a sort of essentially post-money environment as the free energy technologies are made available slowly and surely across the world to those people who are the most responsible people who are going to be concerned with the welfare of the majority of Earth humans and not just the elite groups who have been trying to corner various aspects of armaments and wealth for their own elitist protectionism.
Well, that's obviously good to hear that. Thank you very much. But I'd like to talk about Atlantis and Atlanteans, because I understand you've both had an experience where you found yourself dressed as Atlanteans. I guess that was because you, like a lot of people, you had a link with them. And you mentioned that they looked like Amerindians who had lived 100,000 years ago. Now, since everything is in reality in the now, are you saying that you met people from the past?
That's probably for you, Julie.
It's a great question, and I know Ted will have a comment about this too, and I want to remember to say something, or he may want to, about the white eagle, because not only has he seen white eagles in the present, and white birds have been critical, but one of the beings who shows up at the table is an Atlantean who looks very much like an Indian, who himself sort of appears. He wears white eagle feathers. So that's a very interesting continuity. This is an observation on my part. I think that you were mentioning, Mike, about time not existing, or I can't remember exactly how you put it, but many of the guides who show up have told us, in a sense, that they are aspects of us, both from the past and the future, but in a sense, all of it is happening all at once. And so they show up as guides, and they've told us they also show up as aspects of ourselves. The ones from the past, represent times when we had lives where we were very conscious and effective, and the ones from the future show up to show us, in a sense, how we're going to develop in what we may think of as future time. It's a very hard thing to wrap your mind around at first, but
indeed,
it's also, I think, very empowering. What would you like to say about that, Ted?
We have had a number of Atlantean incarnations, evidently, that we have been, in a kind of multimedia way, been shown to Julie and what those lives were like and how long ago they were and so forth. Atlantis, of course, went on for a very long time. And we have been sort of given many of our past incarnations to try to make it clearer to us what it was we were doing now as we go forward into the future, as our future selves have been revealed to us in a somewhat more specific way than I had believed was possible from what Hilarion had told me fairly early in our channeling experiences. So we have been told really that we are ambassadors to the circumstances on Earth at the present time from the ETs, because just as we were living in many of these star systems in the ancient past and so forth, we now have sort of volunteered for a kind of special role on the Earth at the present time in which we would now be the ambassadors to try to make some of these things known on Earth at the present time, because we're now both writers and so we have these books, and so we're trying to actually make it clear to people who these ETs are, and perhaps the most extraordinary thing that we've been told is that we, in fact, are first-generation Pleiadian hybrids. They told us somewhat in a funny way that we are some of the ETs that Earth humans have been waiting for, and that is our role, and so that's what has been revealed to us. And so it was kind of a shock to our identities, to be sure, but that's the main reason in some ways that we have been the contactees from an early time in our lives. We have been schooled from very early times as children to actually be able to prepare for this, so that we would actually be able to begin to reveal to Earth humans that the origins of many, many people on Earth don't go back just to some particular continent or some particular place in Africa, but actually go far back further into the star systems, and that in the future many people will discover who their ancient ancestors are, just as we have, as Pleiadians and Syrians, because neither Julie nor I actually, as we've been told, had human fathers. We actually had Pleiadian fathers, and we were produced essentially by a technological process that our mothers really didn't know anything about at the time.
I wanted to add to that, just as a footnote too, that we've been told that this is a family lineage, that these ETs are actually our both our ancestors and those who will come after, and that this particular project that we're involved with involves 100 Pleiadian family systems and at least 1,000 humans. So we may have maybe perhaps a bit of unique skills because we're both writers and other things, but that there are a lot more people involved in just this one particular project, and that there are other projects from other ET races, such as the Syrians and the Arcturians and the Andromedans. By the way, we were told that the Andromedans are the ones doing the crop circles. I don't know how that compares with what anybody else has been told. So it is rather startling, and we're not saying that we're completely unique, but it's something that I think a lot of people are waking up to this realization and being open to this idea. Is that something, Mike, that you hear from other people?
Are you referring specifically to the crop circles or in general?
Oh, to the idea of being ET hybrids.
Oh, absolutely, yes. I have no doubt at all that that is the case. There's a lot of proof of it, I believe, even when they look at our own DNA and what they call the junk DNA, which I've been told is sort of higher knowledge when it's activated, if that's the right way, right way to express it. So, yes, I totally agree with you.
Good, but that's good confirmation.
Yeah. Well, thank you for adding that, Julie. That's probably the most controversial thing that we're going to say today, and it was probably the most controversial thing that we heard, and in many ways is the culmination for us probably in terms of identity shock that we discovered in Volume 1 of our sessions, the Star Table Transmissions. Volume 2, the Star Family Excursions, goes somewhat beyond that and goes into many of the other kinds of things that have been revealed to us. But, again, we probably don't have any more time for that today. But we've gotten a pretty good start on this anyway, I think, in an hour.
In actual fact, Ted, we can carry on until we've exhausted ourselves within a manner of speaking. Unless, of course, you have any reason to want to conclude the program for your own personal benefit. So are you prepared to sort of talk on?
Well, I've actually got an appointment a little bit later this afternoon, but I can I can go for a little bit longer. Not for, you know, another hour program, I would say.
Wouldn't be to that extent. I thought perhaps we could finish off talking about some of the information that you're kindly giving us and then allow Julie to come onto the platform and we'll talk for about 10 minutes or so about her book.
Well, I wanted to add to what Ted had said, and I remembered it, and he'll probably have some comments about this too, but one of the things that that we've been told, in my own life I had several experiences, several memories from early childhood, one from the age of 6 and one from the age of 12, that stayed with me as incredibly powerful imprints that I always knew had mystery connected with them, and I never knew why they stood out so strongly in my memory. And so we worked on that in sessions as well. And what was revealed, I don't know if you ever read Mike Whitley Strieber's book called The Secret School, but I would have these memories as a child of being taken to a school underwater where I would meet all these other people and go to school at night. And I also had a memory very vivid from the age of 6 when I nearly died of German measles. So we worked on that to see if we could find out more information about what had actually happened. And so we got a lot more detail about, in fact, we were taken, and I actually encountered Ted in this school. And so that was a surprise, in some ways, to know that that perhaps we had actually been connected in this way or part of this process, probably for all of our lives, as part of this. And I made mention of Whitley Strieber's book because when I read that book years ago, it's probably been 20 years now, he lived, still does, in San Antonio, I believe. I think he's still there. And he wrote a book about his experiences of a secret school. And I was so relieved when I read that book. It was, of course, before I met Ted. So to me, it's fascinating that these ETs have been working with us and many others. When I went to that school, it was filled with people, and it was also filled with ETs coming from other places to learn about Earth, sort of like I don't know what to call it. It wouldn't be as much like a United Nations as it was like a United Nations children's school, where beings, and one memory that I had, we were learning about the history of the Galactic Council. So really fascinating in terms of how work has been going on Earth for a really long time. And we're just beginning, I think. It's waking up everywhere, of course. Ted, do you have any comments about that part and what you might either remember from sessions or your own memories about that?
Well, that was fascinating to me too. I've tried to recollect earlier times in my life when I was a wild child growing up on a farm in Oklahoma. And I knew that unusual things happened, but I never really was able to come up with the kind of content that you have revealed in our sessions. I knew that I had these unusual connections with birds and so forth, and I knew that I was unusual, and everybody else knew that I was unusual, too, and I've always been fairly unusual, I would say, even though I look pretty ordinary for the most part. I went through various kinds of processes over the course of life trying to understand why I was in kind of this unusual position compared, you know, to many of the other people that I knew because I sort of had surrogate parents who were my actual grandparents rather than the kind of families that most of my friends had. And so I've been kind of coming in and out of focus about this my whole life, but finding in our sessions, finding and being told that our real family, of course, are these ETs that we've now met and who have become quite dear to us, was probably the biggest identity shift that I've ever attempted to assimilate. And, of course, I've studied psychology and was, you know, a student at one stage in my life at the Jung School in Zurich, Switzerland, and was preparing to be a therapist, even though I actually became an astrologer instead for various reasons. I finally feel that my life has converged around what it is we've discovered in the last couple of years that made this powerful drive that I had when I was young. I was extremely curious. I really wanted to understand everything very, very urgently in many cases. And I went through a stage when I was a teenager of being afraid that no one really ever would know why we were here and what was really going on, and have gone through many stages subsequently in which so much has been revealed that has answered all of my questions, and I just hope that there's enough time to be able to try to describe some of these discoveries that we have made so that these enigmas that really face many other people in their lives to try to figure out really what is going on. And, of course, whether they're coming from a scientific perspective or a religious perspective or whatever it may be, that they will actually be able to make use of some of this information to help clarify some of the enigmas that they also really have not been able to become clear about themselves, nor to get any help with either. So it's a completely new agenda, I think, that has been released upon the world. And our experiment and the experiment that we have with the ETs who have been sponsoring us and revealing themselves to us herald this new time, which, of course, in some ways is almost a cliche, but has been called the Age of Aquarius or whatever it may be that you might like to hear, the end times and so forth. But something very, very big is happening and is going to be happening on the Earth. And it's not something to be feared because I think one of the things that we have been told most explicitly is ascension is illumination. And so in many ways, this ascension theme that we have heard quite a lot about is really continuous with many of the ancient traditions, philosophical traditions, that illumination really is what it's about, waking up. Human beings are finally going to be waking up in much larger numbers than has ever been the case before, and that will indeed transform human culture and human civilization in a way that we've never really experienced in anything like historical times.
Well, that's great to hear, Ted. It sounds so wonderful. All we can say, I think, is roll on and let's get started.
Well, we're rolling.
I think that's true. It comes into my mind to just say something for this audience that many people may know or not, and that I'm not sure I have total understanding about it, but it's something, of course, I think most of us feel very indebted to Gene Roddenberry and the Star Trek series for many of the things that he brought forth through those stories that I think paved the way for a lot of us to accept this. And one of the things that that we've been given to understand is that there are different levels of councils or federations, in a sense, and that there may be something called a galactic council, a galactic federation that planets and star systems belong to. But there is this other level that in some ways is only dimly revealed that I would call more like, and I don't want to mix up the words, but it's like a galactic council at a much higher level. And it is much more, I would say, spiritual in nature, perhaps more like what often has been called, although this is not really the right word, like some sort of a spiritual brotherhood. But at the level of this council, these beings, for the most part, are no longer in form. They are incredibly advanced and evolved beings of mostly pure energy. They can take some sort of a form that looks like almost pure light. And they're the ones, ultimately, that are really in charge, and in a sense, they even oversee what happens at the level, like of a galactic federation, where people have interstellar capacity of travel and are still working out issues that in some way are still human. We've been told, for example, that the Pleiadians, although they say that they are as much as 4,000 years ahead of us technologically, that some of that advance and evolution took place at the cost of their emotional nature. And so they have, in turn, learned a great deal from humans. So even though, as it's often depicted in science fiction stories, while we're still violent and unruly, there is something very priceless about our passions and our emotional nature that many of the ETs find compelling. So that was also a revelation to me. I'm not sure I still fully understand it. And I think we've also been told that not all of the ETs belong to the Galactic Federation. There are still some that act in a rogue way. But the picture is so much more complex, subtle, and sophisticated than most people have ever dreamed to imagine. But that's about to be revealed in a big way, as Ted was saying. And that's very reassuring to me.
Yes, indeed. I mean, that's brilliant. And regretfully, unless people have developed some interest in these type of subjects and try to gain some information, it clearly is going to be something that's very difficult to grasp. But no doubt plenty of help will be there. Now, I think we ought to talk about your book now, Julie.
Okay, so we can let Ted escape. I know he has another requirement, so he could go at any time. So that would be delightful for me. Mike, I always like to talk about the book.
Yes,
I will probably sit in and listen for another 10 or 15 minutes just because I can't bring myself to break away just because Julie is so good when she talks about these things. So I will be glad to take the back seat here, and thank you very much indeed. And I hope the Goddess book will be a nice segue.
Thank you, Teddy. I think we could have spoken for another two or three hours, but what we have spoken about is very enlightening. Thank you very much.
Okay.
Right, Julie. Right, your book is called Goddesses for Every Day. That's a lot of goddesses. How did you come to find so many and then apply each one to a specific day of the year, because presumably you had a deliberate purpose for doing that?
The little bit of the backstory is about 7 years ago, someone hired me to ghostwrite a novel that took place at about 2,000 years ago and was set in biblical times. And I grew up Catholic, and we always joke that Catholics don't know too much about the Bible. So I needed to do a lot of research to write this book. And in the process of doing the research, I realized that most people have no inkling of what was really going on politically, in a religious way, in the ways of the war, 2,000, 3,000, 4,000 years ago. And that sort of caused me to embark on a path of understanding more. And the more research I did, the more I discovered what I had only known peripherally, that there was this enormous reservoir of information about the feminine side of the divine that nobody taught us in school. And so that was sort of the beginning, and I sort of caught fire to want to contribute in some way my part of helping people, women primarily, but men as well, all of us, reclaim an aspect of that knowledge. So I would have been under the same impression as you, and it's a question I always get. Where did you find all those goddesses? Well, the truth is there are thousands of goddesses and thousands of gods, and they exist in every single culture on Earth as far back in time as I could go. So the more I discovered, then I, as you asked, tried to decide, well, how would I present this and how would I frame it? And ultimately, I chose the frame of the zodiac because it's one that I was familiar with, and it's one actually that most people are familiar with, and it's very ancient. Then became the process of saying, well, how do I divide the goddesses according to the days? And it became a really amazing process, which taught me a great deal about the nature of guidance. And so I divided them by their primary myth or their primary attribute, story, or quality, which to me would resonate with one of the 12 zodiac signs. Some of them appear on their feast day, on a day that they were honored. In addition to that, the goddesses of spring, the young goddesses, appear in spring, the virgin goddesses, the young goddesses of the ones of sunrise. Mother goddesses and moon goddesses, for the most part, appear in the summertime. Goddesses of the harvest appear in the fall, and the old wise goddesses of weaving and fate and wisdom appear in the dark time of the year in the northern hemisphere. So that's the basic way that they became organized. But it was very hard to decide who I had to leave out because there are literally thousands.
Mm. Right, so now you suggest that the goddesses can be used as daily guides. In what way would you use them in that sense? Would you consult them, try and speak to them through mind contact? How would it work?
I've gotten great feedback from different people. For myself, I use the books. I use it in the morning primarily and read the goddess of the day. There is a quality for each goddess, something about her myth, and then something I called a contemplation, which can be used to sort of access the goddess in a deeper way. And I've heard from readers from all over the world, actually. People use it in different ways. Some people use it at night. Some people use the book as an oracle where they might ask a question and then open the book in a seemingly random way looking for guidance. It can be used as a teaching tool just to learn more about history and prehistory, or as a spiritual tool, as I said, using the contemplation to sort of access what that particular goddess represents within us. And I've had wonderful letters and comments from men as well, that the book has helped them sort of connect with their own feminine energy, the energy that is more feminine that resides within them. So there's lots of ways, and I'm always eager to hear what someone else may be doing with the book.
Because you were coming onto the program today, I obviously looked at the goddess for August the 3rd, which is Tautu. And it's interesting that in closing your comments about that particular goddess, you said the Tautuan Games, which ran from 1829 BCE to 1170 BCE, were celebrated as a sort of Irish Olympics, which seems a nice coincidence.
Isn't that great? And you know what's been fun? I love it when that happens. And I should have read the goddess right before the program. I read her early in the morning, and I didn't even know there was such a thing. One of the most rewarding experiences for me about the book is people will email me or let me know when they read their goddess that there is a profound synchronicity, or what we some people might call a coincidence, in terms of how it works. Recently, someone wrote me. I think it was the goddess of around July 24th, 25th, not too long ago. And some young woman wrote me who had just purchased the book, and the goddess, this particular goddess, has fiery red hair. And this young woman was born a brunette, but she dyed her hair fiery red, and she was so struck by the fact that the goddess of her day had fiery red hair. So it was one of those fun, again, synchronicities and coincidences that seem to happen all the time.
Mm. One did of the you best mean, parts. Did you mean when you said the goddess of the day, that for her, that was her birthday? Is that what you meant?
Oh, yes, that's correct. Her birthday, I can't remember if it was recently, July 25th or 26th. So yes, that's right. That's usually the first thing someone does when they pick up the book, once they realize that there is a goddess for every single day. First, they look up their own birthday. And so that's the particular goddess of their day.
Yes.
And mostly people resonate. Occasionally, very occasionally, it's happened that they don't, and so I tell them then, well, just pick a goddess that you do resonate with, and maybe there's something in your astrology chart that's stronger.
Yes, indeed. Now, do you think some of the goddesses that are included in your book were at some stage in the past real people?
Well, I think that's a great question as well, and Ted and I have talked about that too. Some of them definitely were. Some of them are historical figures, and I have included a couple. There's the goddess, forgetting her name, she's Irish too. She was there's a human woman who I'm blanking on her name, who invoked a goddess, who was the only time a particular group of Irish people again overcame the Roman. She's very famous. Everybody knows who it is. I'm just blanking on her name right now. And she was a human woman. There were others in places like Egypt and India. There are several other traditions of who began as human women and who were so remarkable that after their death they became goddesses. And a more recent example, I included in my book both Joan of Arc and Mary Magdalene, and people might argue that they weren't goddesses at all, but they were both human women who later became Catholic saints after a great deal of suffering. And so to me, a saint and what a saint represents is a form of a goddess, so most definitely. And there's also, I think, the possibility that some of the beings that people describe, and especially some of their activities and some of the things that they did in human lives, they may well have been ETs who came to Earth and who were so remarkable and had powers that the humans didn't understand that they were deified. Same with the gods.
I absolutely agree with you there. I think that applies to the Greek gods who were possibly ETs, but there you are. Did you say that men could use this book in the same way, or would they have to have their gods?
Well, I've had that question several times, too. And my answer is always, whether it's correct or not, that we've had an overemphasis on the divine masculine for at least 4,000 years. And I've toyed with the idea of writing a similar book about gods, but I don't know if men would respond to that in the same way that women respond to a book about goddesses. And as I said a little earlier, I've heard from a lot of men, and when the book first came out, I really did a lot of radio programs and was interviewed by many men who really responded to the book, and some of them were reading it daily with their daughters or their wives, or they would read it to each other, and they found it to be very healing. The men seemed to find it more healing, and the women seemed to find it more empowering. So I don't know. What do you think about a book about gods, Mike? Would that be valuable, or do we have too much of it already?
I think you're probably right that men wouldn't quite approach it in the same way, or not, certainly not as many, but having said that, the wisdom in there is applicable to everyone. It doesn't matter whether it's come through the female or the male energy. So I suspect that many men perhaps would read their wives' book about goddesses. So you know, I see no reason why not. But does that mean that when you talk of goddesses, that each one has at some period in our history sort of been exalted and sort of put on a high pinnacle? I mean, have they all achieved something that's notable?
That's a really complex answer. There are places in the world, like Hawaii and India, just for an example, where the goddesses are still alive and well and still revered. And in what's called neo-paganism, which is next to Islam, the fastest growing religion in the world, a god and a goddess are revered, and the idea of the stages of the year are related to the stages of a woman's life, which are often called maiden, mother, and crone. So in some cultures that have been overtaken perhaps by Christianity or Islam in different parts of the world, sort of the era of the gods and goddesses has passed. But in other places, for example, that are alive and well, like in the case of the African people who were taken as slaves to different parts of the world, they had their own rich traditions of gods and goddesses.
Right. Yes, I'm sure through ancient history there are lots of references to the goddesses.
Onto their gods and goddesses. And so they've just kept their traditions. And what's called voodoo is one example of that, still alive and well. And so the secret tradition survives. So in my assessment, all the gods and goddesses have different qualities and powers. And, of course, in the Greek stories, the people who were called heroes were like what Ted and I have described. They had one parent who was a god, and they had a human parent. So they were the heroes. So I think it depends on the culture. I think it depends, and of course, what we call our American Indian cultures, they don't have gods and goddesses in the same way, but they relate to the animal kingdom, to the star nations. Probably the closest one of the goddesses in my book is White Buffalo Woman, who was a spirit being of the Lakota Sioux. And she's also alive and well in their mythology. I suspect that she's an ET. So I think it really depends. It's very complex in terms of what happened to the culture and whether they still have retained their ancient beliefs or whether that's moved into the past. Probably more of an answer than you wanted.
No, it's great. It's good to hear someone who, in their own way, is something of an expert on these matters talk about it. But I think the good news for the future is that the male and female energies will be perfectly balanced, and we won't have these extremes like we have experienced in the past. And maybe this is one of the reasons why someone like yourself has probably felt prompted to write a book like that, to bring the feminine energy is sort of back into our view and to our notice.
Well, that's true, and I agree with you, and that's certainly something that I hope for in a very powerful way, because we have become out of balance, haven't we, as a world and as an earth, and in many ways the male and female energies became quite polarized when we all have both within us. So I think honoring the differences and honoring what we all have and bringing it back into balance is also, I believe, one of the most important things all of us can do to bring about more of a state of peace and harmony.
Yes, indeed. And I think you and obviously Ted are making a very good contribution to that. Now, I think we ought to look to bring the program to a conclusion, but what would you like to say about your website? Have you got an address? Could you tell us a little bit about it and whether you supply your books or articles direct?
Well, thank you so much for asking the question. The best way to acquire the book is through the publisher, newworldlibrary.com. And so their website is easy to navigate, and the book has a page there to purchase. I do have a website. It's my name, julielore.com, and lots of information there about my work. And Ted and I hope to have our own website soon, and he will probably have it under his name or another name, where our material will hopefully be available very, very soon, so more people can read it if they choose.
Right, so I'll repeat that then. Where they can find out the information about your books or buy them is newworldlibrary.com. Is that correct?
That's right.
Fine, okay. Now, the books themselves, are they sort of short books in their nature because they cover your sessions?
Ted, if he's still there, can probably answer that. I think each one is approximately 170 pages. Are you still there, Ted?
Yes, I am. Mm-hmm. Yes,
is that right?
He was wondering about the books that you and I are doing together. The e-books, yeah. Both volumes are currently in a preliminary form, and we have some ideas about how to actually expand them a little bit. We don't want to make them too big. We actually have three volumes underway. The first two volumes are available as preliminary e-books, and if anybody would like to send me an email, and I'll give you my email address in just a moment, I would be very happy to make them available as an attachment by return email. And if they would like to make a contribution financially to help support our work, I would suggest the kind of standard email book cost these days, which is $10. And they can make that, if they would like, via PayPal. And my email address, I'll say it and then I'll spell it. It's aeons@mindspring.com, A-E-O-N-S, at mindspring.com. It's C-O-M in the U.S. That's the com extension. And we will be expanding them. They are quite readable, but most of the information is there in the current form. And we would be very happy, of course, if anybody would like to request these books. If they want to get in touch with me, please send an email to that email address, and I would be the contact person for the first book, Star Table Transmissions, and the second book as well, if they would like to look at that later on, called Star Family Excursions.
Okay, fine. That seems to cover it very well. Thank you, Ted. I don't know whether either of you want to add a final comment before I close the program. Any thoughts of something perhaps that we haven't really touched upon that you would like to quickly mention?
I'll just say a quick thank you for having us, Mike, and then I'll turn it over to Ted to see if he would like to make a closing remark.
Fine. Thank you very much.
Well, it's been really quite a lovely time that we've had together. I've enjoyed it really a lot. I think I've said most of the things that I felt were the minimum that I should try to say today to give anyone a notion of what this is about.
Yes.
So many people have been subjected to so much disinformation of various kinds about ETs over a period of many years that were information suppression programs of various kinds, or indeed because they've been subjected to much of what the entertainment world has given us that has been mostly an attempt to scare us and to push us into somewhat immature modes of response, I'm just hopeful that we can begin to turn the tide a little bit so that people can begin to get some image of the truth of what is really going on with this, which is really the greatest issue of our times, this meeting up with these extraterrestrial human entities who, as we have tried to say today, are in actuality, at least in our case, our own real families.
Yes. Great. Thank you. Thank you very much, Ted. That's a nice closing comment you've made there. And I'm sure both, certainly myself and the listeners, are very grateful for you coming on. It's been fantastic to hear about your experiences. I only wish we had more time to go a little bit deeper into them. But if they want to know more, they know what to do.
Well, we have a second book, so maybe we can look forward to another time. And I would like to thank you very much as well. You're really quite good with your program and your own channel materials. And we are really very happy to make your acquaintance.
Well, thank you very much. And if there's time left this year to speak to you again, I would gladly do so. So you must let me know when your next book comes out. Thank you very much.
Okay, thank you so much, Mike.
Thank you. Well, friends, I say this almost every week. That was another good interview, certainly extremely interesting. Next week, my guest will be Lisa Barretta. She's an author who's written a book called The Book of Transformation, and she sees it as a book which helps you to open to psychic evolution, the rebirth of the world, and the empowering shift pioneered by the Indigos. She also believes that in 2012 there will be a new portal opening into spiritual development, and I believe that's also included in the book, which I haven't read yet. Anyway, so thank you, friends, for being with me today. It's been a lovely time, and I hope you can make it next week. God bless you all. Thank you.